Good evening, everyone. Hello, and welcome to Cure Talks. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Talks, joining you from India. And I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on myeloma. This is our 81st episode, and we have with us our myeloma cure panelists, Pat Killingsworth and Gary Peterson. Joining Pat and Gary on the panel is Jennifer Allstrong of Myeloma Crowd. Welcome to the show, everyone. Our myeloma expert on the show is Dr. Nupur Raji. Dr. Raji is Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School and the Director of the Multiple Myeloma Program, Medical Oncology at Massachusetts General Hospital. Hundreds of myeloma patients and caregivers will be joining Pat Killingsworth this year on Fernandina Beach for Pat's Myeloma Beach Party from Friday afternoon on March 20th, all day on Saturday, March 21st, and Sunday. We are going to hear more about Pat's Myeloma Beach Party and the various activities of the party, about Myeloma Crowd Foundation's initiatives, and lots about myeloma research. With that, I will now hand over to Pat. Pat, you're on air.
Thank you, Priya, and thanks, everybody, for joining us. I thought we've got to take advantage of having Dr. Raji on the program to ask her some myeloma-related questions, so I figured we'd open that way and then do some of the shameless self-promotion toward the end of the broadcast. And, you know, when I started this event, it was just supposed to be a party, but last year we had people come from 9 states. We had it in Tampa. I think we had 65 or so people there, and a lot of them had a lot of questions, and I thought if somebody's going to take the time and spend the money to come so far, we should give them a show and help answer those questions. And so that's what, I guess the event's gotten away from me a little bit, but that's what we have now. We have 3 days and some wonderful speakers and some good quality of life type of things that maybe you wouldn't get at one of these normal educational programs that you can go to. So we're excited about that, and I'm especially excited about having Dr. Raji join us because I've just always been impressed. She's both a clinician that works with patients and a researcher, and she, besides being an incredibly nice person, I first met her 4 or 5 years ago at a media event up in Boston, and I've had a chance to interview her since, and I've just always felt she has a good grasp both of myeloma research and also, I guess if I was up in Boston and you had room in your schedule, doctor, I'd want you to be my myeloma specialist.
That's very sweet, Pat. I appreciate it. Very kind. Thank you.
You're welcome. But so much for the sweet part. Let's kick this off with a tough one right off the bat. So I have one question, and that's, I'd just like you to talk a little bit. A couple weeks ago, they had, HBO had a documentary called Killing Cancer, and myeloma was featured in the first 10 minutes of the broadcast, and it was the measles virus therapy out of Mayo Clinic that they're working on, and they showed Stacy, who was like a miracle patient. She was literally on her deathbed, and they gave her 10 million doses of apparently of this modified measles virus, and she went into almost instantaneously remission, and she's been in good shape ever since. I believe she may have she might be back on maintenance now, but I mean, my God, it's been almost 2 years, and that just phenomenal. And so the you know, they've started a second round or a second cohort of patients, I believe 14 patients. I mean, it's not easy to manufacture 10 million doses a patient. It takes some time. And unfortunately, I've heard from two of those patients. Two of those patients have commented on my blog because I wrote about this, you know, how great it was that this new therapy was featured on the program on HBO. And fortunately, I didn't oversell the cure part. Both patients said that they're in this study and neither one responded at all. Apparently, maybe 5 of the patients had a partial response, but as far as they knew, at least none of the patients they'd talked to had anything near the type of response that this Stacy out of Minnesota had had. And I know this is all confidential type of stuff, but when that's the danger these days, isn't it, doctor? You've got to promote yourself to get the money, and you've got to make a big deal out of you know, when you get some good results, but it can come around and bite you in the butt. And I think maybe some of these patients had unrealistic expectations going into their trial based on the results that were publicized, that Mayo Clinic publicized. So I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about maybe that part of the whole thing, but first explain how this works and why it might not work for everybody.
Sure. No, that's a great question, Pat. And I, you know, at the outset, obviously, there's a lot of excitement with whatever's going on with myeloma. Every week we have something new. You've heard about the Endeavor results this week. We heard about panobinostat last week. So every week something new comes up. Remember, this oncolytic therapy, viral therapy using the measles virus, is still in an investigational stage. And, you know, one has to tease out the media hype from reality. Certainly a couple of patients have done really well, and Mayo highlighted those in a report which they published in their journal, obviously not fully detailed. But remember, when we use these therapies, these are therapies, cellular therapies, and if you think about the concept of this, Pat, and I'm, you know, it's hard to say whether this is the way we should be treating everybody or not, but the concept is actually novel. It makes a lot of sense because what you're doing here is viruses typically infect cells in people's bodies and destroy those cells. And what Dr. Russell's group is doing out here from the Mayo Clinic is using the measles virus to, in fact, infect myeloma cells and thereby kill these myeloma cells. And obviously a process such as this, a cellular therapy such as this, takes a lot and a lot and a lot of work. So it's fortunate that we've seen partial responses. It's great that we've seen a couple of people who've had very good responses as well. But there, you know, this is something which is not going to work in everybody. And that's something for all of us to understand. And the reasons it will not work in everybody is, you know, what Dr. Russell's group from the Mayo Clinic is doing is using the measles virus, adding a gene to that measles virus, infecting that measles virus, infecting the myeloma cells with the measles virus. Now, remember, all of us are exposed to measles. All of us develop antibodies to measles. And folks who have high antibody titers to the measles virus, this kind of an approach is not necessarily going to work. So Mayo, I do know, will be looking at other alternatives also. It's not as if every patient is going to respond to this. You have to make sure that you do not have a big antibody burden. And then you also have to make sure that whatever virus you are creating with that genetic modulation is able to infect the cells that you want to, and in our case, obviously, the enemy cell is the myeloma cell here. So I think all of these things play into it, and, you know, certainly it's exciting in that it's a new approach, but I will caution everybody, it's not end-all, and I think we are early in our understanding of how this kind of an oncolytic viral therapy will in fact work, and where in the continuum of myeloma will it be incorporated. So I think we have to think about all of those things, Pat.
Sure, it reminds me, and you're right about the lot of work part, because I was formerly a Mayo Clinic Rochester patient and got to know some of the staff and the team up there, and Dr. Dispensieri, I remember, was originally working on this. She handed it off, I believe, in frustration, and obviously the key was the dosing. You know, who'd ever think you'd have need massive dosing like this in order to get the effect that you're looking for? And as a matter of fact, a member of our support group or a neighboring support group was in a trial about 4 years ago and passed away. You know, it didn't work, and I think at the time they weren't using anywhere near as much, you know, the dosing was much, much lower. And maybe that's the key. But think about, I know it just boggles my mind thinking about all of the variables. How do you get the right dosing? I mean, when you're talking about possibly millions of doses, the you know, there's an infinite, you know, what might be a good dose for somebody might not be a good dose for somebody else, right, Doctor?
That's exactly right. You know, and that's part of the reason why clinical trials are so, so important. So what is being done is it's being studied in the context of a clinical trial. When we talk about millions of, it's millions of, you know, the dose of the viral load has to be in millions, Pat. So that's something, you know, as with any drug, this is a little more difficult because this is more designer specific. But even with a drug, when we first start out, we start out with a very low dose, and then we keep upping the dose to figure out what the optimal dose level is. So this is kind of similar to that, and they had to reach to these dose levels where they ended up with responses in a couple of people. And then when they've opened it up to a broader group of people, they've obviously not seen the same results, so we have to go back to the drawing board and see what is wrong. Is it an antibody issue? Is it a ability of this virus to infect the myeloma cells in this case? So all of these different factors which might play into how people respond have to be taken into account. And that's why I really think, you know, we all have to take a step back, appreciate the good results, but wait for the science to kind of dictate itself and kind of educate us along the way. And, you know, certainly hopeful, but I don't think everybody, it's not the end-all answer for everybody, Pat, and that's something which is very important for all of us to understand.
Sure, and there probably never be one fits-all therapy, I'm guessing. But, yeah, it's great. It's amazing what you're all doing to try to help keep us alive. I know I appreciate it. And speaking of great, we have Gary Peterson with us. So, Gary, how about asking Dr. Raji a few questions? Or is Gary, are you there?
Pat, can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
Pat, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Great. Having met you once, Doctor, I can say that with you, we certainly have a great resource for multiple myeloma. I consider you part of the young guns of multiple myeloma.
I appreciate you saying that, Gary. Thank you.
Okay, there's you, and there's Dr. Gobriel, and a number of the people on our scientific board that I just am totally just humbled just to be considered in the same group as you guys. You guys are, like I said, there's all those, like Dr. Kyle and all the folks that came before you, but then there's this whole new group of highly skilled, ultimately intelligent, and energetic individuals that are part of this, and you are definitely one of those. So thank you so much for your
participation. I think we're embarrassing her, probably.
I hope not. It's all true.
No, now we need to live up to all of these words, Pat.
This party and multiple myeloma walk are all part of a program to educate patients, raise awareness, and help to fund research. And you're, like I said, one of the remarkably skilled new guns, young guns in the myeloma profession with more than a full plate. I mean, you can keep yourself busy all the time without adding anything new to your plate. So why did you choose to be part of this new multiple myeloma crowdfunding initiative?
So, you know, what was very striking to me, Gary, about the Myeloma Crowd Research funding initiative was, you know, this is a novel way of doing research, raising money for research, and really incorporating not just the research expertise and the academic expertise, but mostly, you know, it's a nice collaboration between the myeloma specialists and patients, and getting a patient perspective on to this whole what should be funded, what should not be funded, because sometimes when we are doing our research, we kind of, you know, can get lost. And I think all of us are doing this for one very simple reason. We want to make this better for myeloma patients the world over. We want people to live longer, and we want to cure patients. And so getting that patient perspective piece into this myeloma crowd research initiative was actually critical. When Jenny called me and asked me if I'd be willing to be a part of this, I told her, God, Jenny, this is going to be an honor for me, because ultimately, you know, whatever I do, even the work we do in the lab, Gary, I think our central, at least my central focus has always been, is this going to be helpful to my patients? And if the answer is yes, it's a no-brainer, right? You have to do it. So, you know, that's what helps guide what we do with research. And, you know, getting this initiative in place was just a very cutting-edge new way of thinking about research, new way of thinking about raising funds for research, and new way of having kind of a peer review process where initially you're doing a scientific review and then you're presenting it to the larger myeloma community, which includes patient advocacy as well, to really understand the and make sure that we are spending our money in a worthwhile direction.
Well, thank you so much, Doctor. One of the things I see is, like, most drug companies have to get a return on their investment. And, of course, they have to please their shareholders, me being one of them. So generally, a drug has to have a huge payback to obtain funding. And I believe most funding comes from large drug companies. Does this Myeloma Crowd Initiative, research initiative, hold promise for older drugs, non-drugs, and those with a poor financial payback, which may be the cure to make it to clinical trial?
No, absolutely. I think you've hit the nail on the head here. And, you know, part of the reason to do this, Gary, is, you know, I don't think anybody is in this for what are the returns here, what are the profits, what's the business plan. That's not what we are talking about here. I think what this is going to allow us to do is good science, which is vetted science, by the research community, by expertise in the field, and by patients as well. And really, the end of the day is, you know, whether we use it to develop older drugs or whether we use it to understand or do science in a more, you know, in a better fashion, because, you know, funding is a problem right now. And certainly Big Pharma can fund their big clinical trials, but they don't necessarily fund the right science to back those clinical trials. The other thing is there may be a lot of stuff we might want to do which is very scientifically driven, but not necessarily in the best interest of a pharmaceutical company, for example. And that's the kind of research which I think will happen through this kind of an initiative, which is the Myeloma Crowd Research Initiative, I think. So, you know, I'm honestly looking forward to how this all pans out. I do hope we are able to fund and do really, you know, groundbreaking and transformative research, so to speak, which can really impact patient care in the next couple years also.
Yeah, that's my hope as well. So you've helped me confirm that in my own mind. Pat, did you want to have somebody else ask a couple questions? And certainly, I got more. You know,
sure. Let's hear from Jenny.
Oh, hi everyone.
Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Jenny.
Hey, Dr. Jenny. Hi. My question for you is more about precision medicine. So in the last few weeks, the White House held a very large Precision Medicine announced a large initiative that they wanted to fund precision medicine. And I know based on the research that you have done, some people may or may not know what that is, but I guess you can explain that. And I know you've been working on like targeting BRAF and things like that. As we look for, so I guess first my question is, what's the relevance of that to you and your research and in the world of myeloma? And then the second question would be to relate it back to what we selected as for this Myeloma Crowd Research Initiative. When we asked you and the other doctors that are involved, what's the most critical thing to go after? Most of you just emphatically said, go after high-risk myeloma. And when I first started doing the interviews, similar to this Cure Panel interview about a year and a half ago, I would ask people about the testing for these high-risk features or specific genetic features like BRAF and NRAS and KRAS. And people said, well, you can test for them, but really it's not going to make a difference in your treatment. And based on the work you're doing, based on work other people are doing, and now we're seeing proposals come in specifically for high-risk features, it's really important for patients to know what type of myeloma they have, is it not?
No, absolutely. I think it's critically important for people to know. It's critically important for us to look, because unless we look and see what those genetic mutations are, we're not going to know that they even exist, and then we're not going to get to the next level of whether or not we should be targeting them. So as of right now, I'm going to tackle your questions twofold, Jenny. Your first question was on precision medicine, I think. You know, we in the myeloma world are a little bit behind the rest of solid tumor oncology in terms of precision medicine. And the reason for that is very simple. It's simple because it's not that we don't understand the genetics of myeloma as much. It's because myeloma tends to be a very genetically complex disease. It's not as if it has a single genetic mutation which is driving myeloma. We've now done whole genome sequencing on multiple myeloma patients, and, you know, we found lots of different genetic abnormalities, and there's not one single driver mutation which is dictating what happens to myeloma. And just a, you know, simple example for folks to understand would be, you know, when you have CML, for example, that is chronic myelogenous leukemia, you have the BCR-ABL kinase gene which is affected, you have that impacted, and once you target that, you're going to see long-term survival. Well, that's not true in myeloma. What we've seen in myeloma is, you know, the incidence of some of these targetable mutations is quite low. So we, at least at our institution, will do bone marrows even at the time when the disease comes back, and I think that's critically important to do that bone marrow. And, you know, there are a lot of kind of molecular testing platforms now available to do those on these marrows. And these are platforms which will allow you to test for genetic mutations. We at Mass General use what we refer to as the snapshot analysis. You know, throughout the rest of the country, there's the Foundation Medicine platform available as well. There are other platforms which are being developed, like I know at the Dana-Farber, they're developing the OncoPanel. So, you know, as long as it's done and as long as we can figure out what that signature of your myeloma is at that time, it's really useful. We've actually gone ahead and, as you pointed out, done a trial, which is very different from how you think about trials for multiple myeloma. Specifically, you know, most of the trials that you hear about, think about are for either newly diagnosed or relapsed refractory myelomas, and it's all multiple myeloma patients. What we are now doing and what I've been fortunate to be a part of, it was called a basket trial. Now, this basket trial included all kinds of tumor types, and the only unifying piece here was the BRAF mutation. Now, based on our whole genome sequencing studies, we know that in myeloma, the incidence of BRAF mutations is about 4 to 6%. So if you test 100 people, you're going to find 4 or 6 out of those 100 who are going to have this mutation. Now, if you have that mutation, that almost always tends to be a driver mutation, and we then can use a single agent like vemurafenib which is a BRAF inhibitor, which in the myeloma world is not, you know, most of our folks who have myeloma have not heard of what vemurafenib is, but I've certainly had patients who've been treated with vemurafenib and as a single agent have had nice responses, and we are going forward doing a larger study. We've looked at other mutations, Jenny, and those include things like KRAS and NRAS mutations. And these KRAS and NRAS mutations have, you know, they are present in a higher proportion of patients. It's seen in about 20% of people. And we hope to have targets going forward. And those clinical trials are just in the stages of being developed as we speak, where we would like to use drugs like MEK inhibitors, which is what these KRAS, NRAS mutations kind of signal through. So I think our understanding of the genetic platform or the genetic mutations in myeloma is going to be critically important. Having said that, I do want everybody to remember is once you have the BRAF mutation does not mean that the BRAF inhibitor is the answer to all of this, because myeloma, unfortunately, is very smart and it tends to keep outsmarting us. So your BRAF inhibitor is able to control your myeloma for a little while, and then as is typical of most myelomas, the disease comes back again with a different clone which takes on significance. So I think testing all of these at different stages of when the disease comes back is incredibly important, and going forward, the way science is moving, our hope is that we will, understanding first these mutations is going to be relevant, and then finding the right target for those mutations will also be critically important. And that's how, you know, we at the NCI, which is the National Cancer Institute Steering Committee, are trying to create platforms where we can then treat patients based on just genetic abnormalities. So that's where we are with kind of precision medicine. We're still very in our, I would say, in our infancy stages, but I'm happy to say at least that we are moving forward in the right direction. And over the next few years, we learn more and be able to do more. As far as high risk is concerned, you know, the definition of high risk changes. Now, when we think about conventional definition of high risk, when you talk about BRAF or some of these other mutations, they don't necessarily categorize into high risk. When we're thinking about high risk, we're thinking about the true conventional, you know, FISH parameters, where we're looking at deletion 17, for example, the 14-16 translocation, for example. Those are kind of considered the high risk features, because as of right now, although these patients do way better than they did several years back when we didn't have all of the treatments we have today, they are not doing as well as, you know, we would like myeloma patients to survive for years and years and years, and that's not necessarily happening in this subset of patients. And that's why when you asked us the question is, where is the unmet need, you know, we go around and I go around the country, the world, talking about how great things are with myeloma and how much we've learned and how much better we are getting. But there is a subset of myeloma patients who don't do well. And I think it's really critical that we identify what that subset of patients is and how can we use treatment strategies to kind of overcome those high-risk features. So that's kind of a slightly different from precision medicine, and that's where we really need to focus our attention. It's a much smaller group of patients, and that's why when you look at clinical trials, Jenny, you're not going to find people just focusing on high-risk populations because they're very hard to accrue to. There's about 20 or 30% of people, and, you know, it's hard to get everybody onto that one trial. But I think that's where, again, working collaboratively, working together, educating patients, educating the clinicians who take care of these patients, that there are options for these folks, and kind of studying them in a concerted fashion is going to allow us to make some progress going forward.
Well, thank you so much for answering it that way. It's a great way to answer those questions.
Thanks, Jenny. Priya, I'd like to, are there any listeners that would like to ask a question?
We have quite a few listeners back. Listeners, if you have a question for our panel, you can please press 1 on your keypad and we can bring you on air to ask your question live. Or if you want to send it, yes, we have a caller online. But
this might be a record, Priya. Be halfway through the show and be taking calls.
503-727-5303. You are on it. Please ask your question.
Yes, doctor. Thank you very much for your presentation. Over the last week, there was some information released regarding a head-to-head battle between high-dose Kyprolis versus Velcade, but it tended to, I think it had to do with relapsed only, and as you can read on the Myeloma Beacon, it seems like there were some issues with respect to the trial, arguably, for example, whether patients had been previously treated with Velcade or Kyprolis in the past and whether that had an effect on the ultimate efficacy of the test. Question for you, do you see this affecting frontline treatment? For those of us that just started Cyborg-D, for example, we're obviously focused on Kyprolis versus Velcade.
Sure. So, obviously the Endeavor study, which is what you're referring to, was a very positive study suggesting nearly a doubling of the progression-free survival in the Kyprolis arm compared to bortezomib. You're absolutely right about pointing out that these were patients who had prior proteasome inhibitor therapy. I don't think we have the details of the trial just as yet. But I think the important message here is, a lot of the patients who went on to that study, for example, had previously received bortezomib. And therefore, the data for the bortezomib arm is going to be a little bit weaker for sure. I think end of the day, whether you use bortezomib or carfilzomib, these are both good drugs. I think one or the other should certainly be a part of whatever treatment you're getting for your myeloma. As far as a head-to-head comparison, the upfront study, we are doing a study, and that combination is carfilzomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone versus bortezomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone. And that combination is being studied in ECOG trial. It's accruing as we speak. Now, whether or not that trial is going to allow us to see the differences between these two is not clear. The way to think about this, though, quite simplistically is, you want to put a couple of drugs together. In your case, they're treating you with bortezomib and Cytoxan, and that's perfectly reasonable. And end of the day, you have to make sure that you get into the best possible response that you can. And that's going to dictate what happens going forward. So all of these drugs are good new drugs. And which combination to use over the other is, that's something we're going to learn along the way. I think over your lifetime, you're pretty much going to see each one of these drugs, whether you see them all up front or you see them later on in the course of your disease is, depends on where you get treated and so on and so forth. So I don't think that's going to make a huge difference, to be honest.
Thank you.
In fact, we can continue with the discussion.
Oh, they're excited to be. They're escorting a group down your studios. They're in India, I guess. I don't know who had their.
That was Mass General and an ambulance coming into our emergency room at Mass General, which is.
There you go.
10 minutes, yeah.
So I was kidding before that this might be a record to have a caller get to ask a question halfway through, because our panelists tend to like to talk, as you've noticed. We don't just ask questions. It take about 5 minutes before we finally get them out. Jenny, you're pretty good at that, though. You didn't do that so much, but I think this is the type of thing where. Again, to have you come down to Florida, which, and by the way, for the record, Dr. Raji's not taking advantage of this, unfortunately. She's flying down and flying back in the same day. Can you believe that? So she must love that Boston weather. But
I know, right?
To take the time to do that, you'd be exhausted. You're going to need Sunday to recover probably, but hopefully you can walk on the beach a little bit, and stick your toes in the water.
There you go. I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be fun, exciting, and you know, it's good to get your perspective on whatever all of us are doing, and you know, working on this collectively really makes a big difference. So absolutely, I'm looking forward to it. It'll be fun, Pat.
Awesome, and we are going to have some downtime, but Dr. Raji is going to be featured in a Q&A with patients. I mean, basically that's what we're going to do. We're going to do this type of thing, and Dr. Raji will be there. And if you've got some questions, you can ask him up close and personal. So Gary, you had a few more questions, or I'm sorry, Priya, were there any other callers that wanted to ask?
I have a question, Pat, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
I didn't want to take
yeah.
up too much time, but Dr. Raji, you've done work on HDAC inhibitors also, and we've seen so many new announcements in the last 2 weeks. It's really stunning, all the FDA approvals. So with tanabinostat being approved and several of the others now coming coming into for newly diagnosed patients, how do you as a patient, or how do you recommend that your patient choose between combinations, let's say, you know, a tanabinostat combination versus using a monoclonal antibody type of combination if somebody is in the relapsed refractory environment? With the benefits, I guess, of so many new announcements is that you have more tools in your arsenal, but at the same time, it's a little more confusing for patients.
Absolutely. So really, it also depends on what the relapse was, how the relapse was, and what you have in terms of a trial. Drugs like tanabinostat, as you just heard last week, Jenny, has gotten the FDA approval based on the Panorama data, Panorama 1 and 2, which I think is really exciting for myeloma. This is a new class of drugs which has been approved, and I've done a lot of work, not with Pano, but with the newer version, and that's called ricalinostat, and we're still early in development of ricalinostat. The differences, though, is, you know, Pano is it's more of, by the name, as you can tell, Pano is more of a pan-HDAC inhibitor. So certainly works, certainly has high response rates, certainly improves progression-free survival, but with it being more of a pan-HDAC inhibitor, it tends to be a little more toxic as well. So although it is approved, I think it's going to be used with some caution, with a lot of monitoring, and people need to be able to tolerate it. So a lot of what we end up picking for patients depends on, you know, existing comorbidities, what they can and cannot tolerate, and then ultimately dose adjusting so that you are able to tolerate these drugs and do as well as you can. So Pano is great. I'm specifically working on this more selective HDAC6 inhibitor, and what we've seen, you know, we have phase 1 and 2 studies which are ongoing as we speak, and we've been able to keep people on these drugs for a long time, and in general, these have been fairly well tolerated. Obviously, we'll have to wait and see in phase 3 trials whether or not we can reproduce or whether or not they will pan out in terms of efficacy. We are certainly excited. I think it's the first time that we are seeing a class of drugs which, as a single agent, does not have a lot of activity, but again, based on science, we decided to combine it with either an IMiD or a proteasome inhibitor, and the data there looks really quite promising. So that's a good thing. As far as monoclonal antibodies, you know, we are very excited about monoclonal antibodies, and it's not so much, you know, I know everybody worries about have I picked the right treatment or not. Ultimately, none of these monoclonal antibodies are as of yet approved. So if there is a clinical trial which is right for you at your site, take advantage of that clinical trial. The way we see some of these drugs is, you know, they are not targeting certain genetic abnormalities. So we hope that these are risk-agnostic treatments, and even in high-risk disease will actually play out by targeting whatever protein that they are supposed to target. In general, monoclonal antibodies are quite well tolerated, and we have you know, there's excitement around three of them right now. You have elotuzumab, which you'll hear the data on in late May, early June at the ASCO meeting. Then you have a couple of, you have daratumumab, which has been, you know, the data on daratumumab looks amazing and very exciting. And then you also have the Sanofi-SAR compound, which is very close at heels. It is the same target which daratumumab targets, which is CD38. So all of these, I think, hold a lot of promise. And in the course of your disease, if you can have access to these drugs, it would be fantastic to have access to them. So, you know, work with your clinicians, work with your healthcare team at your institution and see what's available. And ultimately, again, depending on where you are, the eligibility of those trials, you will be exposed to them. And again, like I was saying to the earlier speaker, whether you pick bortezomib or carfilzomib, it doesn't matter as much as of right now. Well, you know, end of the day, you are going to have exposure to all of this, and it is incumbent upon us as a research and an academic community to try and get these approved as quickly as possible so that you have the choices available to you and you can actually pick and choose. We're in a happy place, Jenny. It can be a tough position to be in, but I'd rather be picking and choosing drugs as opposed to saying, yeah, I have 1, 2, and 3, and that's about it. So, having the luxury of choices and options as the disease keeps coming back is always a good thing. How it plays into the continuum of treatment is something which is going to evolve over time. I don't think we know whether treating upfront is the best thing, treating at relapse. End of the day, my sense is that we're always going to be using a cocktail of drugs and antibodies. It's going to be very similar to how we treated HIV in the old days. And, you know, myeloma has certainly become a chronic disease in the majority of patients, not all patients, which is why we want to focus on high-risk disease. But in the majority of patients, that chronic has to become even more chronic, and even more chronic is, I think, the first step to curing the disease. So I do think with all of these options, we're going to hopefully get there. And how we sequence them is going to be something we're going to learn over the next 5, 6, 7 years going forward.
Well, I so appreciate having the options. I think it's really been miraculous what's been happening in myeloma. And what it tells me is that if I'm going to get my very best care as a patient, I need to be going to a myeloma specialist who has access to some of these clinical trials that knows in detail what's happening in the world of myeloma. So to me, it's just an extra push that says I need to be seeing a specialist.
Wow, you and Gary sure agree on that, Jenny, and of course I do too. It's it's too much for a medical oncologist to, you know, they're not going to have enough patients to justify the amount of work it takes to understand all of these different therapies and which patients. Which therapy might work best. So I think you're absolutely right. Gary, quickly, did you have another question? And then we need
sure.
to get into that shameless promotion of the event part.
Well, I'm looking forward to your shameless promotion, by the by.
Well, you're looking forward to the event. You've just got to take the ferry across the river, and bam, you're here.
That's the plan. So, Dr. Raj, we have some remarkable progress in low-risk disease, but success in high-risk myeloma, as you had noted, has escaped all of the smartest minds in the world. And as I understand, in most myeloma, it will morph into a high-risk presentation. Yet most clinical trials do not focus on high-risk disease. I think you mentioned before that you thought that was a key. And I think you're absolutely right. I think that if you find the cure for high-risk myeloma, you find the cure for all myeloma. Why is there such a void there in clinical trials, and what are your thoughts about how we might be able to overcome this?
Sure. So that's a tough question to answer, Gary. I don't think necessarily that there is a void. I think the issue is how we design trials. So what we typically will do is design a trial for all myeloma because, you know, just focusing on high risk, you don't want to forget about the patients who are going to do any well anyway. Because remember, the 80% of patients, if you really give them whatever a high risk patient is going to get, you know, that, like you said, Gary, is probably you're going to cure those patients. The other thing to remember is risk is an evolving definition. You know, in the old days, you know, we called having deletion 13 a poor prognostic factor. We don't refer to that as a poor prognostic factor anymore. We still call deletion 17 a relatively poor prognostic factor, but we don't know what happens in the context of using, say, elotuzumab or in the context of using daratumumab. Our hope is that if we subject patients to treatments such as this in our clinical trials and are able to demonstrate an efficacy in people who we today define as high risk doing better than not getting the drug, that would allow us to then focus and hone in on this for specific trials. We are actually beginning to do this already, Gary, so that there is a push to work collaboratively, all academic institutions, and part of the issue is numbers for high-risk disease, right? If you just focus on high-risk, you don't have as many patients, and myeloma is not a common disease, as you all know. You know, on an average, you have 25,000 patients who are diagnosed in this country with the disease, and then if you narrow it down to the 10% who have high-risk disease, at the outset, you're narrowing it down to very few patients, and not all patients are candidates for clinical trials. So those kinds of limitations do exist for all of us. Having said that, in the relapsed refractory setting, we as consortiums, we as groups come together and work on clinical trials where we put patients on these trials collaboratively and try and learn from them. So there is an ECOG initiative looking at high-risk disease. And, you know, the one thing to remember is which is, again, a good thing, by the way, we keep redefining risk. And why do you redefine risk? You redefine risk because what was bad risk yesterday is no longer bad risk today. So that's also an evolution, and that's something which all of us need to embrace, need to understand. And that's why, you know, we need to morph our clinical trials depending on how we're defining risk. So I think end of the day, it's important that we treat people uniformly. That means use one kind of a protocol, treat them, and then see what the impact of that treatment are on standard risk, high risk, low risk, and then identify by doing so, are you still able to identify a high risk population or the treatment cocktail that you have has been able to overcome those high-risk features. So those kinds of studies are already happening. But again, if we can focus on genetically agnostic kind of treatment strategies, I think in the long run is going to be a better feature. Going forward, you know, we've talked about different themes here. We've talked about doing more precision medicine and then talking about more kind of global risk agnostic medications. And end of the day, I think the platform for trying to really control this disease for a very long time is going to be a combination of all of these. So combinations of what we already have with some of the newer drugs like the HDACs with the monoclonal antibodies. And I do want to include cellular therapies in this. You know, we're making advances with cellular therapies. We started off the radio conversation talking about oncolytic therapy, but there's something else which we haven't talked about, and that's CAR T cells, which are T cells which are engineered to try and attack your myeloma. So that would also be an approach which is going to be irrespective of what your genetic risk is, and to use modalities such as this in kind of, you know, either sequentially in continuum or collectively together is ultimately going to get us to a point where hopefully we will not have low risk, high risk, moderate risk, but all myeloma will be kind of, you know, very treatable with a very, very long-term outcome.
Well, you have your own lab named after you. Congratulations on that.
Oh, no, it's not named after
most
me.
People have to.
It has my lab, that's all.
Well, most people have to die to get something named after them. And here you got your own lab. And as part of that, it works on the microenvironment of multiple myeloma. Mm-hmm. And actually, we haven't heard a bunch about that. We heard a little from Dr. Gorbriel. Do you know what does that hold for the does that hold promise for myeloma treatment and maybe high risk and low risk disease?
So I do think it holds a lot of promise. You know, we do both looking at the microenvironment as well as the tumor cell. And I do believe that the tumor cell is not, you know, all of these drugs which we have, drugs like the proteasome inhibitors, like the IMiDs, play a very significant role in the microenvironment as well, Gary. And when I talk about the microenvironment, it's everything which surrounds the myeloma cell. And if you think about this conceptually, you know, sure, you want to attack the myeloma cell, but you also want to take care of whatever's surrounding the myeloma cell, which is feeding the myeloma cell. So a lot of the drugs that we've already talked about, which have been approved for myeloma, don't just work on myeloma. They do work on the microenvironment. For example, bortezomib actually has very profound bone effects, as does Kyprolis or carfilzomib, and the newer ones as well. And going forward, you know, I think it's going to be a balance of seeing these bone, or not just bone, but everything targeted the microenvironment. So when we talk about cellular therapy, we're talking about the immune cells in the microenvironment. So some of the monoclonal antibodies, like the daratumumabs and the elotuzumabs, how do they work? Sure, one mechanism is them killing the myeloma cell directly, but another mechanism of how they work is their interplay with the microenvironment, and in this case, it's mainly the NK cells and the T cells. So these are the ones which are then upregulated, and these are the ones then which then help fight your cancer. So I do think all of these also play a role in the microenvironment. All treatment that we have for myeloma to date works on the tumor and the microenvironment. We in my lab have specific, you know, my focus in the microenvironment, I'll try and study the bone a little bit more because, as you know, bone disease is a huge problem in myeloma, and we have made headways. There's still, you know, those clinical trials are very early right now, Gary. They are phase one trials. So phase one trials are still going through their dose escalation phases, but they are ongoing at least at not just my site, but a couple of other sites as well. And we just have to wait and see whether what we thought was going on in the lab really translates into what happens in people. I will tell you that early data we've seen bones, so these are kind of bone healing agents that we're working on. And in the long term, you know, what I would foresee is most myeloma patients are treated with drugs like Zometa and pomidronate, and the future is going to be, yes, you will have Zometa, pomidronate, and maybe denosumab one day. But in addition to those, we'll also have some of these bone anabolic agents like antibodies to activin A, which we're actively studying. We're trying to figure out whether DKK1 plays a significant role. So these are all ongoing studies, and until we are sure about which way to go forward with these, you know, that's part of the reason why you still haven't heard about them. But they are kind of not direct myeloma targets. They're trying to improve the surrounding microenvironment. And ultimately, in my mind, you know, if you really want to cure the disease, sure, you have to target the tumor cell, but you really have to make the environment less friendly for myeloma cells to reside in. And if you're able to do that, I think you are going to see long-term disease control. And for those kinds of studies, we're going to have to wait years. You're not going to be able to know the data overnight, right? It's going to take a longer time for us to figure those out.
Well, thank you so much, Doctor. And Pat, now I'll let you get on to your what did you call it?
Shameless promotion.
Shameless promotion. But before that, I just got to say, it's just not Dr. Nupur Raj. I think from now on, she should be known as Super Duper Nupur.
That's very sweet.
Jerry, stop trying to pick up our guests. Doctor, that does make me think about that. Is it, should I drop the E or is the E pronounced?
Say it again, Pat.
Is it Raj or Raji?
It's Raji.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be mispronouncing your name. I just wanted to take a moment, and if anybody is thinking about coming to the event, we still have about 18 spots. There's going to be $20 to register, and that includes four meals, believe it or not: dinner on Friday night, lunch on Saturday, dinner Saturday night, and brunch on Sunday. And we're only charging that fee. That's sort of a skin in the game type of thing, so that people how it is. If you sign up for something and there's no money involved, you're more likely to, if something comes up, not to come. But we're using that money to actually help people that can't really afford to come, help pay some of their gas money or pay for a hotel room. So these registration fees are then, a lot of that money is going to go back to some patients and caregivers that otherwise couldn't afford to come. So if you're listening and you've been thinking, I'd like to come, but it's just, you've got a hotel room, and they're not inexpensive. It's $100 a night probably to stay here. It's spring break in a touristy type of area, or it's too far to go or whatever. We can actually, I just did a post about that less than a week ago. You could go on my blog and look and get some details. But the idea is to get the online myeloma community together face-to-face. So many of us, sometimes I email with people practically every day, and I just thought it would be nice for it to get us to get to know each other. I mean, it is so inspiring. It is so energizing. Last year when, we probably stayed too late there around the Tiki Bar on the waterfront in Tampa, but I just didn't want to leave. It was just so great talking with everybody, so I'm looking forward to that. And this year we have the added attraction or bonus or benefit of having Jenny run this walk on Saturday morning. And I wanted to give Jenny a chance to talk about that a little bit, if you could, Jenny.
Oh, sure. Well, we're looking forward to the walk, and then we're helping put together the dinner as well. And it's been so fun working with Pat and to do this together. So I'm so glad that we're joining forces to create an event that will be an annual event and something we can look forward to every year. I think I'll back up, Pat, if you don't mind, and just give a little bit of perspective about what the goal was to help fund research, and that's part of the work of the run will be to do that. Our hypothesis starting out was that patients need to have a seat at the table to help find a cure. After interviewing so many doctors like Dr. Rajay, they're working so hard, they're doing so many good things, and they need help and support. NIH has dropped funding, and it used to be that, I don't know how many, Dr. Raja, you probably know more, but maybe 1 in 8 were funded, studies were funded or proposals were funded, and now it's more like 1 in 12. And they need our help. And if we need a cure, I had to ask myself, do I want to wait for the standard process to be able to find a cure? And the answer to myself was no, I don't want to wait. So I want to get involved and do something. So with that hypothesis, we decided to start the Myeloma Crowd Research Initiative, where we bring together some of the top researchers in the world in myeloma and combine them with a team of patients who are highly active, very well-educated myeloma patient advocates. And then we went through the process to choose a target. with it, which is the high-risk target, which is what some of the doctors said was the most important target to go after. So in looking at this walk, it will be working to fund this research initiative. We have several things coming up, and just to give you a little transparency about our process, we called for letters of intent during the month of February. Researchers around the world from many different countries submitted proposals, and the doctors, the scientific advisory board, is now reviewing those proposals and will narrow that number down to about 10. And then we will gather more information about those proposals and involve the patient community in helping to select that, including the patient advisory board. So it's the first time that really a patient group, a very well-educated patient advocacy group, has come together with just an amazing research team to help select these proposals. So that's kind of the background. The walk will help do that. And as you think about myeloma and where the cure will come from, I kind of think, you know, what dollar will cure myeloma? It could be that it's $1. And then you think, where will that money come from? Myeloma is a small patient community. A lot of times you're not feeling that great, and sometimes you don't feel like you can donate. But we will be presenting some things that the myeloma patient community can do. And every time someone's diagnosed, I know this happened with me, and I'm sure it's happened with others on the call, is that when you get diagnosed with myeloma, you have this team that surrounds you that says, what can I do to help you? And it's sort of challenging because sometimes you don't want to open it up completely and say, well, you know, come and clean my house or whatever. But we, just to give you a little preview, we'll be putting together activities that people can do on that team, donate, of course, but, of course, other things that they can do to help spread awareness and to help basically fan out so we have more support in the myeloma community to help find a cure. So as part of the beach walk, the beach walk will be a really fun event, and we will be having different stations along the beach walk where there are some preview things that you can do to help spread the news about myeloma awareness, especially with it being Myeloma Awareness Month. And then the dinner event on Saturday night will be something I don't think you want to miss. Dr. Rajay will be speaking earlier or late afternoon, and then we'll be going into the dinner, and we'll have entertainment as well. So I'm really, really excited about it. It will be a really fun event and something I don't think you want to miss.
It'll be nice to get everybody together, won't it?
Mm-hmm.
It really will be. And, yeah, somebody will be taking Dr. Raji back to the airport about the time we start dinner, I think.
So I'm going to miss dinner, Pat?
You're going to miss. Well, you won't leave hungry. Let's put it that way. We'll get you something to eat.
Maybe we can put a doggy bag together for her.
There you go.
So just to mention, too, if you can't attend Pat's Myeloma Beach Party and you want to walk and help support research in myeloma, we have an option that you can walk where you are. So if you look at the myelomacrowd.org site, on the upper right, there's a link to the beach party. And one of the registration options are just walk where you are. If you're going on spring break and you want to get a shirt and we'll send you a towel, and you want to walk where you are and take photos of yourself, we'll include them on the Myeloma Crowd website. So there are lots of ways to support the event and the research initiative.
I'm blogging about that tomorrow, too, Jenny. So that was a great idea.
And I think from the perspective of this group, it's, you know, if you look at the UK, they've done an analysis, and they find that only 3% of the entire population of the United Kingdom has ever heard of multiple myeloma. And I doubt if we're much different than that. So we got a huge mountain to climb, and it's these kinds of initiatives, I think, that can make the difference. And we've already, you know, and if you look at what we've done so far, it's been remarkable with what little they've got. We get half the funding of all other cancers, yet, you know, this group, which includes Dr. Raji and all the people on this panel have come up with some great, great things. And just think, if we gave them the resources that all other cancers got, just twice as much as we're getting right now, which is what other cancers get, what they could do. So, you know, I'm just so excited about this possibility. And just to get the word out, you know, people just don't understand. Even the LLS, the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, doesn't even include us. And we're bigger than lymphoma, you know. We don't even get billing.
They do get some funding. But
No, they're great.
Yeah, not the
they
billing,
give us
right.
some funding.
but they dropped it from the name.
They don't even include us in our name. No wonder nobody's heard of us.
You know, Gary, it's like a sports team. It's good to have a chip on your shoulder and a little bit of an inferiority complex that keeps us all on our toes and working.
That would be me.
Priya, should we wrap it up, or do you have any more callers that have been waiting? We don't want to cut somebody off.
No callers, Pat, but I think we have actually exceeded our time. And Dr. Raji, thank you so very much for being with us today. And Jenny, Gary, and Pat, thanks a lot. And the link for today's show we'll be sharing with all our participants. It will be on Cure Talk's website by tomorrow. And Pat, I'm wishing you your party the very best. Hope you guys have a great time. I'll be waiting for the pictures. And Jenny, I particularly liked your walk where you are doing. It's very nice. That's very inclusive. I really, really appreciate that. And we'll be meeting again after Pat's party on March 26th. With Dr. Ben Singer, where we'll be talking about allotransplants. So please visit curetalks.com for RSVP for the event. Thank you, everyone. It was a great discussion.
Priya, I should have mentioned that Cure Talks is sponsoring the beach walk and the beach party. So thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
Your organization is one of the sponsors, and we really appreciate it.
Thank you,
Priya and Pat, Jenny, Gary. It was great being on your talk show, and I look forward to seeing you in Florida.
Yeah, see you in a couple weeks.
Thank you, super duper nooper.
All righty, bye.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.